Hello, listeners. This is Gina Zimbardi, your host for the Go Nuts podcast. I have a few announcements before we get started with this month's episode. First, our annual conference is coming up August 9th through the 12th at Delaware Valley University in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Please make sure you check out our website at nutgrowing.org for more information. Registration should open soon. If you do not have an email address, you can find our registration in our printed nutshell, which will be arriving at mailboxes sometime at the beginning or mid-March. Secondly, we are still working toward the 1,000 member mark, so I really need your help. The Northern Nut Growers Association cannot do what it does. That includes its podcast, that includes its Facebook, that includes the nutshell and the wonderful conversations that we continue to have without your support. So please consider becoming a member today. It's $40 a year and it benefits us greatly. So if you are interested in becoming a member of our organization, please visit our website at nutgrowing.org or contact me at contact@nutgrowing.org. Well, that's it for the announcements. Please enjoy this conversation and go nuts.
With him or something. They're from that same small town. So yeah so that's kind of what I know of it. Dad has spoken of it, and you know, I grew up in that area, so we had walnuts everywhere and everything. I don't do a lot with nuts now, but you know, just because of how our division of labor is. But honestly, a tree's a tree, so I deal with kind of all those pest issues.
Yeah and I'm so interested to hear more about that. Usually with this podcast, I'll count down from three just to get us started to mark us in. But we've already started the conversation, and that's exactly what I want. I just kind of want to converse with you on like what you want to do. But that's really neat that you've already heard of it and you've heard of the organization. So like my goal for the Northern Nut Growers is to really make connections with different worlds. And I think what you do, and I was reading up on your background and how you created your extension program, is we need to be connected directly into that. So can you like talk a little, well, first of all, can you introduce yourself to the folks at home and talk a little bit about what you do?
Sure. My name is Dave Coyle. I am an assistant professor at Clemson University in the Department of Forestry and Environmental Conservation. I have a 100% extension appointment in forest health and invasive species. So that means I deal with any of the bugs or fungus or other crud that impacts trees, whether that's in someone's yard or in a natural stand or a plantation setting. I deal with a lot of the invasive plant detection and management. And, you know, in a general sense, I help people better manage their land, and I am continuing the fight against invasive species in this part of the world.
Oh, that's amazing.
Thanks.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit how kind of how you got started with this? Because, you know, I read a little bit about your background, and you mentioned it sounds like your parents were a little bit involved, or you just...
How far back you want me to go? You want me to go back to the beginnings? Because that's kind of where it started, honestly. So I grew up in southeastern Minnesota, a small town called Preston, Minnesota, right by a large state park, Forestville State Park. And my dad farmed with the neighbor, and, you know, mom had some jobs here and there, but she mostly raised my sister and I. But every day they would just, you know, mom just sent us outside. Mm-hmm. So I took my little red BMX bike and I would just ride around either into the forest, into the state park, into the forest, or, you know, through the pastures, through the fields. And I just developed this, you know, curiosity and love for the outdoors. My dad was really good about encouraging that. He was one of those kind of self-taught naturalist, you know, guys. Seemed to know everything about everything, and I never knew how. To this day, I'm still not sure how he knows how much he does, but he just, you know, they just fostered that, and then it waned in high school because it was kind of uncool to be into that sort of thing. But you know, when I was littler, I was in 4-H, and one of the things I did was take an insect collection to the fair. So that's when I got really started in entomology. And then when I got to Luther College, where I did my bachelor's, my advisor was an entomologist. So into entomology, I worked with him a little bit, you know, kind of as a summer job. And then that led to a master's degree at Iowa State in entomology and forestry. And honestly, I got kind of lucky getting there because, you know, I got a bachelor's degree at Luther, and I think I thought that with a bachelor's degree you could do anything in the world, and that's not entirely true. It qualifies you for a few things, but not a whole lot in the realm of science other than kind of entry-level stuff. So I had this choice between a master's degree at Iowa State or going with my best friend to a small town in northeastern Iowa and working at his roofing company for a couple of years, making a bunch of money and going to Europe. And while the latter sounded super awesome, I took the more conservative and probably more grown-up route, and I went and did a master's. So I sort of lucked into that is how I tell it. But everything took. I liked what I did. I got fairly good at it, and then that led to a job in South Carolina. So I lived here from 2000 to 2002. 2000 to 2004, and I worked for the U.S. Forest Service. Learned all about southern pines and the southern forest ecosystems and all that. At the same time, I was from the north and I'm half Norwegian, so my Scandinavian blood told me this is too warm down here, and I was sick of sweating every day. So I moved back to Wisconsin, did my PhD. My field work was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan by a little town called Watersmeet, and the project I had looked at these invasive insect pests, both above and below ground. So part of what I had to do was sample roots and these root feeding larvae year round. So I would be up there in December, scraping off 3 feet of snow, digging through the dirt. And I think at that point, I just realized that, I don't think I'm meant to live up here anymore. I think I'm kind of over this cold. And then when the opportunity came to moved back to Georgia for a postdoc, I did that. So I came back to Georgia at the end of 2010, did more in the realm of southern forest health, worked with a lot of pine, a lot of people around the region. And then I started a regional forest health extension program in 2015. The Forest Service helped me get that going. And I worked with all 13 southeastern states. So from the forest of the southeastern region goes from Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Kentucky, Virginia, that's kind of our border, and then everything in between. So I served as a educational or informational consultant, basically, for all 13 of those states. And I mostly work with the state agencies, the forestry commissions or forestry divisions. I would go to several states a year and do, intense in-person workshops with the field folks, a lot of online training, a lot of webinars, that type of thing. And then just over a year and a half ago, I landed at Clemson doing similar things, but with more focus on the state of South Carolina. So that's how we got where we are.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. I very much relate to your discussion on going for the master's degree. I did the same thing in English, and I applaud you for not running off to Europe.
So did my parents, actually. They were pretty happy I stayed stateside. we all have choices. I really did luck into it. And I tell students all the time, grades aren't everything, man. Mm-hmm. My grades were not good. I will freely admit that now because I have a full-time job, but my grades were not good. I did not take college seriously for a long time. But I worked hard and, I tried hard and I worked hard and I was teachable. And I think that to me is a much bigger, a much more important thing to have than just inherent brilliance is being teachable and being coachable. That to me is more important.
Absolutely. In a different life, I was an English professor, so I know that exactly. I walked away from my PhD after completing a dissertation because my committee and I decided that we didn't agree. So I completely understand. And now I do this and I love it.
Yeah. A PhD is a funny thing too. That's the other thing I tell people. Don't just do a PhD because you think it's going to be cool to be a doctor. Like it's not that cool. And it's a lot of years of really hard, stressful work to get there. And I tell students, if you're going to do that, know why you're doing it. Don't just do it, for the title, because nobody even cares, honestly.
Exactly.
Do it because you want it or you need it to get to a certain career point. And that's what really drove me back. If there had been more opportunities for advancement when I was with the Forest Service with the master's, I don't think I would have gone back, honestly. Mm-hmm. But it got to a point where, because of the term position I was in, there was a time limit to it and there was only so much I could advance there. And, I learned through that technician work that I wanted to have more control over what I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I loved the, you know, my boss was great. He gave me tons of freedom, but it's at the end of the day, I did what, you know, what boss wanted, you know, and I realized that I wanted more freedom to kind of run my own program and answer my own questions. So that's what got me going back.
Yeah, exactly. I'd love to have a podcast episode where I just talk to people about kind of the constrictions of PhD in the academic world, but that would be its own kind of beast to tackle.
You should do that while people are at a bar having cocktails. That would probably get, you know, even more realistic.
Yeah. And yeah, I think some liquid courage is needed to discuss these things.
Yeah, it never hurts.
Absolutely. So you're into kind of forest health and ecology and entomology. Kind of, what's your area of speciality? Kind of, what do you like to focus on?
Right now, I would say I have two main things. The first thing is pine health, which is mostly pine bark beetles in this part of the world. The southeastern U.S. is very, you know, pine-centric. We produce a huge amount of, you know, pulp wood for all your paper products. So we have a lot of pines that grow in plantations, you know, pines in lines, they're called. I jokingly say it's basically the corn of the South, right? Mm-hmm. So we grow it in rows. We can rip through a full harvest rotation in sometimes as few as 22, 23, 24, 25 years, which is really quick. So a lot of what I do is bark beetle management. I help people do the right thing silviculturally so that their trees don't get bark beetles. Okay, so that's probably a big part of it. The other research stuff I do is all dealing with the impacts of invasive plants. Right now we're focusing a lot on calorie pear, which I know you folks have up there. It should be turning, you know, brilliant white blossoms everywhere in the next couple, 3 weeks for you. But it's a really bad invasive species down here. It takes over, you know, roadsides, old fields, and we're seeing it start to creep into our pine forest as well. We're working a lot figuring out what's the best management method for it. You know, it can be killed with herbicides, but you've also got the thorn issue to deal with too. And once you kill it, then you've just got a thorny, woody skeleton sort of sitting there. So what do you do about that? And we're looking at the ecological impacts too, because, you know, anecdotally, nothing eats that plant. You don't ever find insects on it or anything. So from a, you know, a pure ecological perspective, especially if you're a bird, and there's a lot of birds that feed their young on caterpillars, every calorie pear is like a dead zone, right? So mm-hmm. there's no food on there at all. So when you've got a whole field of them, you know, what's a bird going to eat? Where are they going to go? So I'm convinced that there's some impacts, you know, up the food chain, and we're working now with, I got some colleagues here at Clemson, we're working to figure out what exactly is going on with calorie pear and some of these other non-native woody plants we have as well.
That's really interesting. What other invasive plants are you seeing south? I'm more used to, well, first of all, I'm English, not forestry, but I'm learning. So I know
sure.
The invasive plants and species I know are more northern. So what other invasive species are you seeing, plants and bugs in the southern U.S.?
Yeah, we've got all sorts of plants. You know, you've got a lot of honeysuckle and that type mm-hmm. of thing up where you're at. And we have, you know, our honeysuckle kind of comes to the down into the Appalachian Mountains. So we get it in the, you know, North Alabama, North Georgia, upstate South Carolina. But then it just turns to privet. And I know there's mm-hmm. privet up there too. So our privet is kind of our dominant shrub invasive that we have to deal with all the time. You know, we've always got to consider it when we're doing our forestry activities. We've got a number of invasive vines, Japanese climbing fern, wisteria. You get into the Florida and by the Gulf, you've got this thing called air potato, which just is like it sounds. There's these big leaves and vines, and you've got these potato-like tubers hanging there everywhere. And then we've got a really nasty invasive grass called grass. It's just down here in the deep south so far, but it grows incredibly fast, incredibly thick, burns incredibly hot, and it's a real, real bear once it gets established somewhere to try to get rid of it. So we have a number of states have programs that will help landowners eradicate Kogon grass to try to hold this thing off. That's probably our number one concern. The big reason is in forestry down here, we use prescribed fire very commonly as a management tool, both to reduce fuels, but also to take care of some of that vegetation. And a lot of our pines are adapted to deal with that. Like you can burn, you know, through most pine forests, especially longleaf pine, you can just send a fire through there and the pines aren't going to die. But with Kogon grass, because of the way it grows, as those leaves grow up and die, they just stay standing. So in any sort of Kogon grass patch, half of it is just dead standing leaves. So when a fire goes through there, it just pulls the fire up. It gets incredibly hot, and it gets hot enough to where it will actually kill those fire-adapted pines. So it's a big, big impediment there. Those are some of our biggest invasive plants. And, of course, calorie pears, you know, getting out of control here. Mm-hmm. The biggest invasive insect slash pathogen we have is this thing called laurel wilt. And this is a fungus that is on an ambrosia beetle. Both are from China. First was detected in 2002 down by Savannah, Georgia, and it hits every plant in the family Lauraceae. So in the Midwest, that's sassafras, but as you get down here, it's things including bay trees, red bay trees, what are the other ones? You've got avocado is a really important one down in Florida. It's really knocked down the Florida avocado industry. California is rightly concerned as well, as is Mexico, because if we're being honest, that's where guacamole comes from, is those huge avocado plantations in central Mexico there. And laurel wilt's hard. There's nothing you can really do about it. There's no effective management. You know, we just try to prevent the spread, try to make sure we know where it is. Single trees can be protected with pesticide, but it's a doozy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I've heard of that one. We had our annual meeting a few years ago in Tifton, Georgia, and there was a talk or two about it, or it was incorporated. It's something that's not affecting nut trees, but I believe the citrus folks were talking about it. It feels really weird because it's like different communities of who grows what trees. So, but I am
right. Yeah,
it's interesting. So you talked about. Part of what you do is helping educate and communicate with farmers or people who are growing trees or growing crops to help them combat these invasive species. And you talked about using fire as a method, but what other ways do you educate the populace on how they can combat these invasive species? Or just be good stewards of the land, I suppose.
You know, a big thing we do is just getting people to know that a lot of things that they can buy at the box stores and online to put in their yard are non-native invasive things. Mm-hmm. And Calabri pear is a prime example because that thing comes from Bradford pear trees, which were planted all over the place, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You can still buy different cultivars of that Pyrus caloriana, like Chanticleer and Aristocrat. You can buy those at any Lowe's or Home Depot. But these are the reason we have these calorie pears all over the place is because they're not, you know, they are self-sterile, but as soon as a different cultivar or a shoot from a wild one comes up, then everything gets pollinated and you've got viable seed. So there's a lot of people that don't make that connection, that don't realize the Bradford pear in their yard actually leads to all the white trees you see everywhere every spring. And then that goes for a lot of other things too. Eleagnus is a very common genus of horticultural shrubs that is once planted all over the place. That's how privet started. Privet started as a horticultural plant, you know, and it was planted everywhere. And then it gets away, and now here we are. It's one of our number one invasive plants we have in the region, at least. So just educating people on what is out there and what it leads to, and a lot of people, you know. There's a keeping up with the Joneses mentality a lot of times. Mm-hmm. If neighbor A has a nice white Bradford pear, well, by golly, I'm going to get one too. Mm-hmm. And people don't realize there's all sorts of really great native options for whatever you want. You want something that flowers pretty in the spring? There's native options for that. You want something that turns pretty bright red in the fall? There's native options for that. And I think a lot of times people just see what's there and they just want more of it. Versus actually, you know, they're not going to do the work to figure out what their options are. And I understand that that's not everybody's thing. People have their own jobs. But as education or extension people, that's kind of what we need to do. And that's what I've been trying to work on a lot is tell people what, you know, what you have and what it becomes. And here's some native options you can put in there instead.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, and I imagine you guys are in a warmer climate, and as someone from Minnesota, you understand. And here in the north, we have a more limited options, so I imagine
Yes.
you have a wider selection.
We do, but at the same time, there's not we don't have that many different things that turn nice colors in the fall. Like the north definitely has more colorful fall foliage.
This is very
South
true.
has South has the spring flowers beat by a mile, I'll give you that. But yeah, there's only a few things we have that turn a really brilliant color in the fall. And some of those aren't native, and that's why they get planted a lot, because boom, you get this pop of yellow as a ginkgo, or you get this pop of red as a Bradford pear, right? And most people just don't think, well, you could put a black gum in there and that actually turns a brilliant red too. So it's just one of those things that people don't put two and two together, or just simply don't know. And that's on us to make sure people are aware of their options.
Excellent. I'll try not to this when this fall comes around. I live next to the Cuyahoga National Park, so I'll try not to take for granted our beautiful fall foliage.
Yeah, you shouldn't. You would be you, or maybe you wouldn't be amazed at how many people drive to the mountains every year just to
Oh
see the
yeah.
leaves.
Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah,
I
I
get
mean
to climb
that's
them. I
it's even more limited here because you've got to go to the Appalachian Mountains. So there's only so many roads going north out of Atlanta or north out of Charleston, and they just get absolutely clogged if you're on there at the wrong time. So.
Yes, I completely understand. That's a common complaint I hear in the fall, especially further south, is the slow drivers looking at the trees.
Yeah, no kidding.
So what interests me when you're talking about what you do with extension work, it sounds like you deal more with homeowners and home growers. Is that true, or do you deal more in a commercial setting?
It's probably a good split, 50-50. So, the homeowner things get more attention and press, but I might even say more of what I do is with the professional crowd. I work really closely with a lot of state agencies down here, the South Carolina Forestry Commission, NC Forest Service, Georgia Forestry Commission, all those groups. I work really closely with them, either in a one-on-one capacity with the state, forest health coordinator, or I'll do workshops for the field folks, part of my job as a specialist here at Clemson is I make sure that all of our forestry and natural resources, and to an extent, our horticulture county agents for Clemson have the training and knowledge they need to be able to handle those landowner questions. So a lot of that stuff happens. It just doesn't get as, widely publicized because it's an in-service workshop for Clemson Extension or something. But that is a really big part of what I do. Everything from the in-person stuff to, handling questions via phone call or text or email, putting together fact sheets for them or one pagers. We're in a position right now where spotted lanternfly is probably going to get here at some point. So one of the things on my to-do list is make a one pager for our South Carolina state parks, so they can have kind of a one pager put up everywhere. Have you seen this bug type of thing, right? Just to get people aware of what they, if you see this, say something. So making things like that is one of those sort of unheralded tasks, but I think it has a really big reach. And that's, one of those that I'm working directly with the parks, but it's something for the public. So that kind of toes the line on both those groups.
Absolutely. And a resource that I can give you, spotted lanternfly has been a big discussion in our world. And in fact, a connection I'd have I'll connect you with is her name's Louise Bugbee, and she's, which I think is ironic that she's an entomologist and her last name's
Yes,
Bugbee.
it
She's out of the Pennsylvania Extension Service, and
Okay,
her work
yeah.
is on spotted lanternfly. And in fact, she presented a really good talk on it last year at our conference in Iowa, actually Iowa City. And she has done some wonderful work. Their website has fantastic work on the spotted lanternfly, so that's definitely a resource that I would love to connect you with, just so you don't have to reinvent the wheel as it goes.
Yeah. And I've worked with several of those Penn State folks. I don't know her yet, but I've worked with, Heather and some of those other folks in that program. So yeah, and everyone that's not Pennsylvania is basically looking to Pennsylvania to see what they have done and what they have discovered, and we've all had conversations with them. One of the most valuable things I did. There was this big Spotted Lanternfly Summit a couple of years back up in Charlotte, and we went to that. And all the Penn State folks were there, and we said, as a state who doesn't have this yet, what do you recommend we do now? Mm-hmm. And that was really good information. And basically they said, you need to get your act together and be ready. You got to know who's responsible for what, how do things get delegated, what's the order of reporting, have materials ready, because once it gets there, it's going to be like a fire hose of stuff happening. Mm-hmm. So we're really took that to heart. We're really trying to get things ready. You know, I mean, it's not an if question to me, it's a when. It'll be here at some point.
Yeah.
And just trying to get people aware that this is going to be out there, be looking for it. Cause you know, odds are it's not going to be one of us professionals somewhere that sees it. It's going to be some homeowner that sees mm-hmm. this pretty bug and takes a picture, and you know, who knows from there, right?
Exactly. And I remember, probably 5 or 10 years ago, we had the same issue with the Emerald Ash Borer that just mm-hmm. ate its way across the East Coast. And
yeah,
at that time, I wasn't really involved a lot with forestry, but even like as a civilian or a pedestrian, like even I was seeing this literature information about it. So I can understand, you know, getting that information out to the common folk, as it were, and letting them know to keep an eye on it. It's very important.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I mean, they're the eyes and ears of the state. We're not everywhere all the time. So we rely on people to tell us if they see something wonky. That's kind of what we say. If you see something that looks off, just let us know. We would rather be able to just say, you know, that's nothing to worry about because it's this.